One of the most effective things that a leader can do for the people for whom he has a responsibility is to pray for them. And a verse I jotted down was Colossians chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. For this cause we also, since the day we heard it, did not cease to pray for you in the desire that you might be filled with the knowledge of his will and all wisdom and spiritual understanding, so you might walk worthy of the Lord and to all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. This is a verse that this is a prayer that the Apostle Paul is making here for these people over in Colossae. And you remember that the Apostle Paul had never been to Colossae. He never visited that church. The church was started by a man named Epaphras, whom we think the Apostle Paul was one and trained for Christ. And now Epaphras is out here heading up this church. And there's a division of opinion as to what was going on in the church. Some people feel that they were facing some real problems, major problems. Others feel that the church was going along so well that Epaphras had gone over to Rome just to tell Paul how well things were going. So there's no real way of knowing exactly, except for the fact that we know that Epaphras was in Rome to report to Paul on something, either problems or blessings. What do you think Epaphras was doing while he was in Rome? The thing you got to remember is Colossae was kind of a second-rate city. By the time that the Apostle Paul was writing and this church was there, it was a kind of a one-horse town. It had a tremendous earthquake and knocked down most of its buildings. It had never really recovered from that, and economic disaster, and the olives weren't selling well, and the sheep wool wasn't selling well, so it was kind of a disaster area. Second-rate place. And now here is this guy, Epaphras, in Rome. Now, Rome is the center of everything. Rome has got everything. Rome does everything. Rome is the big, powerful capital of the whole world in those days. And here's a guy from a place like Colossae out here where everything kind of knocked down from an earthquake and kind of a second-rate dump and nobody really enjoys going there. And he's now in Rome, and you'd think he'd be sightseeing or taking pictures or buying postcards or visiting this or visiting that. But Paul writes to these people and says, Epaphras, who is one of you, a servant of Christ, saluteth you, always laboring fervently for you in prayer that you might stand perfect and complete in all the will of God. Colossians chapter 4, verse 12. Well, I take that to mean that Epaphras, this guy, is one crackerjack of a leader because he understands what the real business is really all about. He is praying for these people. I put this away, but I think I'll bring it back. There's one other verse. I don't normally share this with people, and you'll see why in a minute. But when I began the work in the Midwest, and we had moved to Lincoln by this time, lived 2 years in Omaha with Bob Stevens in the home there, and Ron Rohrbaugh and the different guys. Then they came to the Glen. What we used to do, and I guess the LDI is kind of resurrecting this, what we used to do is we called it a win, build, send. So we'd win people to Christ, and we'd build them up in the faith as best we could. Then we'd send them to Glen Eyrie. That was the only option open. So we'd send them to Glen Eyrie, and then they'd come here and meet Lauren Sandy, and meet Jim Downing, and meet Rod Sargent, and kind of get influence from that end of the thing. And so the guys would come. So Bob Stevens came, and he ran the auto shop, and this other fellow came. Ron Rohrbaugh was in the home, and he ran the print shop, and so on. Well, I had a new crop of guys, a bunch of young guys. They didn't know very much. They were just sort of feeling their way. But I thought, well, we'll move them into the home. And a guy named Jim North and Bob Vedano and Ray Ho and Marvin Smith and Larry Blake. And so here they were all down in the basement. And I really had it on my heart that I really wanted these guys to amount to something for God. That was really on my heart. So I devised a little scheme. I've always been an early riser. I like to get up early. So I would visualize myself getting up out of bed, and in my mind I'd see myself going down to the basement where the guys were in their bunks, and then picking them up one by one in their pajamas, you know, and so I'd stand beside the bed, and I'd hold this guy up. And I'd say, now, Lord, here's Bob Vedano. So then I'd visualize myself just holding Bob before the Lord, and then I'd pray for him. Pray about all the stuff that Bob was going to be. And I'd put him back in bed, and I'd pick up Jim North. And then I'd put him back and pick up Marvin Smith and pick up Ray Ho or pick up Larry Blake or whoever, Russ Johnson or Don McDonald. All these guys that were in the basement, I would just see. And the thing that caused me to do that was a verse I'd memorized in Exodus 17:11. When Moses lifted up his hands, Israel prevailed. when he let down his hands, Amalek prevailed. Remember the passage? Remember how Joshua was down here in the valley and battling with Amalek? And Moses saw something interesting. Now, Joshua was doing the fighting. Moses is up here on the hillside watching it. When Moses would lift up his hands, the battle would go this way. When he let down his hands, the battle would go that way. Then he lifted up his hands and Joshua would start to win. He let down his hands and Amalek would start to win. And he saw that he was the key to this battle. So he just got some people along and they propped up his arms and he stood there and prayed all day and Joshua won the battle. So I took from that that what I needed to do was to pray for these guys one by one, like Moses had prayed for Joshua, praying that God would help him in this battle that he was in. And every one of these guys, of course, they were either out at the university or working at the air base or whatever. So praying for these people, it seems to me that that is really the heartbeat of a leader's responsibility. Now, do you think that the Apostle Paul ever had an answer to prayer? Yeah, probably so. Can you think of one? It wasn't answered. Well, it was answered, but it wasn't really sort of like he really wanted it answered, did he? In 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 10 and 12, 10 and 12, the Apostle Paul says, night and day, praying exceedingly, that we might see your face and might perfect that which is lacking in your faith. Now, verse 11, now God himself and our Father and our Lord Jesus Christ direct our way unto you. And verse 12, and the Lord make you to increase and abound in love one toward another and toward all men, even as we do toward you. Now, apparently there were two major problems in the church at Thessalonica. One, there was a group of people in this church who weren't very loving. They just didn't have much love in their system. Others didn't have much faith. So on the faith, he says, night and day, praying exceedingly, that I might see your face and might perfect that which is lacking in your faith. And, you know, you're in a church and you want to buy some new blankets for the nursery or something. Well, there's always people around saying, we can't afford it at this point. Well, this is not the time to buy blankets. You know, the economy is, you know, or you want to build a whole new million-dollar extension on the end of the church. Boy, this isn't the time to do that. And you'd say, dear God, if they could just have a good dose of faith. Now, when you're out in your ministry, you'll have people like that. And you say, Lord, if they could just believe you, just learn to take real steps of faith. The other thing, of course, was this matter of love. And they were kind of unlovely people. So Paul was praying that your love may abound yet more and more. Lord, help these people to be people who know how to. They're kind of cranky. They're hard to get along with. And you know how it is when you're around people that are cranky and hard to get along with. It just makes everything sort of sour. So, Lord, work. So he's praying about two things. Faith and love. Now, what follows 1 Thessalonians? 2 Thessalonians. Very good. You're still awake. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 3. Now follow this. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 3. We are bound to thank God always for you, brethren, as it is proper, because that your faith groweth exceedingly, and the love of every one of you toward each other aboundeth. The very thing he'd been praying for was now happening. So if you want to see real changes brought about in the lives of people that you're working with, pray specifically like Paul did. He prayed for their love. He prayed for their faith. And when you see it happening over here in 2 Thessalonians, you almost have to read this with a sense of excitement. We are bound to thank God always for you, brothers, because your faith is growing, your love is abounding. See, the very thing that he was praying about, this was happening. Now, we're prone to think that if we can just preach to people about these things, it'll happen. If we can just somehow sit them down and give them a good sermon, give them a good verse, give them a good, you know, shaking up a little bit. But over the years, as I've watched this ministry, it seems to me that one of the most effective and powerful things that we can do is to pray. Some of you know the story, I'm sure, of J.O. Fraser. He was a man who was one of the successors to Hudson Taylor in the China Inland Mission, and he wrote a book called Behind the Ranges. The reason he wrote a book called Behind the Ranges is that at one point in his ministry, he was responsible for a group of churches over here beyond these ranges. Here's this big range of mountains. And he lived over here, and here was this church. And so he would preach to these people and so on. And occasionally, not very often, rarely, on rare occasion, he would climb these ranges. He'd go back over beyond the ranges. And here were these churches. And they were doing great. Much, much better than the church over here that he was with all the time. And he said, how can this be? He said, I live here, I preach to these people, but I get over here, and I hardly ever see them, but they're doing so well. Much better than these. Then it occurred to him, of course, the reason. The reason is that he prayed a lot more for these people than he did for these people. Because these people were right here. He could preach to them and talk to them and tell them all kinds of good stuff. But these he hardly ever saw. So here, he just spent his major part of his time praying for them. And these people over here then, he discovered, were doing much, much better than these people over here that were listening to his sermons. So he concluded that there are four major responsibilities that you have if you want to see people really make progress in their Christian walk. Four things. Prayer, and the Bible. In that mix and in that order. Prayer, and the Bible. But you see, somehow, you and I really believe that if we can just sit them down and give them enough Bible, it'll do the trick. But it's my observation that it's just the opposite. If you can give them a lot of prayer, it'll more than do the trick, much more so than just preaching to people. So, the leader's responsibility, pray. We looked at this matter of wholeheartedness when we were studying 1 Peter chapter 5. There is another thing that goes along with wholeheartedness, and that is to set your heart on something. I call it single-mindedness. I was up in Canada, and they called it set your heart. I kind of like that. Set your heart on this thing. Be single-minded, not scattered around with everything. In Joshua chapter 1, verse 7, it says, only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it, from the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest. Now I've looked it up, and this is not really the picture of someone who is doggedly pursuing the wrong track. What this picture is there in Joshua chapter 1, verse 7, is a person who is generally on track. And then they see something over here to the right, and they say, hark, that's interesting. And then they say, you know, I'm off track. So they come back and continue, and then they see on the left. Hark, that's interesting. So then they say, hey, wait a minute, I'm off track. So then they come back, and that's kind of the way they go through life. Not really off track, but not really on track. Sort of sidetracked. Now, there are three ways to waste your life. If you want to know how to waste your life, I'll give you three ways right now. One, of course, do nothing. Give in to that lazy streak that's in you and do nothing. And you'll just waste your life. The second way is to spread yourself so thin you don't do anything well. So at the end of your life, you've never really accomplished anything. You've dabbled here, dabbled there, and dabbled the other thing. Spread yourself too thin. Do nothing. And the third way is to give yourself to the wrong thing. And thus, waste your life. That has all kinds of applications. One, Thomas Edison made millions of dollars through his inventions. But he wouldn't let them give it to him. He would let them give it to him in dribs and drabs, little dab here, just enough to live on. And then he'd take a little bit more, just enough to live on. Because he knew if he took all these millions, you know what happened? He'd become an investor and give up inventing. And he wanted to be an inventor. Because he felt that he was, you know, this was his thing. So rather than allow himself to get sidetracked with all this money, what'll I do with this, what'll I do with that, what's the market rate here, what's the percentage over here, and all that stuff, how that can consume you. He took his money in little teeny dibs and drabs so that he wouldn't get sidetracked with worrying what to do with all this money. It's a kind of a discipline. Discipline in your mind to stay with that which you know God wants you to do. Because there's all kinds of people coming along telling you what to do. And you think, for instance, I've been on Lauren's team for a number of years. And years ago, I remember we had a little group called Lauren's Assistants. And this was Bob Foster, and I think John Crawford was the head of the Glen at the time, so he was on it. and Rod Sargent, of course, and Jim Downing, and myself. I think we were the assistants. So we'd meet with Lauren every now and again in his office and help him decide things and give counsel and advice or whatever. But I remember from time to time there would be Christian leaders come along, and they'd want to get time with Lauren. So Lauren would say, sure. He'd say, Leroy, you want to sit in? Yeah. So I'd sit over in the corner and I'd listen. And you'd be amazed at what the Christian world out there thought the navigators ought to be doing. They'd sit with Lauren and say, now, Lauren, listen, and then A, B, C, D, E, you know, this is what we think the navigators, and then next week somebody would come with just the opposite, Lauren, this is what we think the navigators, you know, there were all this going on. But I've watched Lauren on this. Lauren Sanney can be maddeningly slow at times in things, but you never catch him off base. You never catch him sidetracked. He is always on track. I've never seen the guy off track. Well, that's a tremendous challenge, because when there's all kinds of pressures, and there'll be pressures on your life to do this, do that, do the other thing, but what you've got to figure out is, what does God want me to do? And then give yourself to that, a single-mindedness. And this is the way, by the way, that I think you really accomplish something in life. Dawson Trott was like this. Dawson had a tremendous mind, but he did not allow himself to think about everything under the sun. He marshaled all that intellect he had on one thing, and he just stuck with that and stuck with that, and people would get upset with that, but he would stick with it, you know. So a single-mindedness, I think, is really important in a leader. I remember Billy Graham speaking at Dawson Trotman's funeral. He said, people say to me, that Dawson Trotman, he's got a one-track mind. And Billy said, and I tell people, thank God, I wish I could get on that same track. He said, here's a man who did not say these 40 things I dabble at. Here's a man that said this one thing I do. So set your heart single-mindedly. You know, find the God's will for your life and then stick with that. Yeah, let's turn to Exodus 18. I was wondering if we would have time for this. I think we will. This is a very, very well-known passage on management and leadership. And there's just a couple little things I want to point out in here. Verse 13. Came to pass, we're in Exodus 18 now. You with me? Exodus 18, verse 13. It came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from morning until evening. Now, you notice Moses himself is out there in this work, helping these people. By the way, in spite of Exodus 17, verse 4. You know what Exodus 17, verse 4 says? And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, what shall I do to this people? They'd be all afraid to stone me. So they're not really all that loving a bunch. He doesn't really have a happy little team around, see? They're about ready to stone the guy to death, but nevertheless, he's out there giving himself to them. I jotted down the margin of my Bible, even though others fail us, we must not fail them. Okay, so verse 14, and when Moses' father-in-law saw that all that he did to the people, he said, what is this thing thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning till evening? And Moses said unto his father-in-law, because the people come to me and inquire of God. And when they have a matter, they come to me, and I judge between one another, and I do make them know those statutes and laws of God and his laws. And Moses' father-in-law said, the thing that thou doest is not good. Thou wilt surely wear away, both thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone. Hearken now unto my voice, and I will give thee counsel. And Moses said unto Jethro, counsel? Who are you to give me counsel? I am Moses. I am Moses. I mean, really. You want to know what I do to get counsel? I go up in that mountain over there. I sit down on that mountain, and God himself speaks to me. Who are you to give me counsel? He didn't say that, did he? Tremendous lesson here in leadership. Phenomenal lesson. It is a fact that Moses got personal directions from God. But when this man came along and offered counsel, his heart was open. Terrific thing. Terrific thing in the life of a leader. Okay. Hearken not to my voice, I'll give thee counsel, and God will be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring their causes unto God. Well, of course, that's what I did morning by morning with these guys in their bunks. I would hold them up to God, bring their causes unto God, praying for people. Verse 20, and thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws. That's the word. So you got to teach the word to people. And show them the way that where they must walk and the work that they must do. So their walk with God, their service for God, teaching them the word and praying for them. Basic, fundamental stuff that a leader must do. Now, then he takes these people and he begins to appoint others that can help him. Moreover, verse 21, thou shalt provide out of the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of 50, rulers of tens, and let them judge the people. That's not all that easy to do. By the way, when you've been all that involved, begin to let loose of some of that stuff and let others do it. But he said, you got to do it, so okay, he did it. But when you do delegate like that, what you've got to do is make sure that people understand what the objective is, have the objective very clear, and then allow them to use their own gifts and abilities and methods and ways of going at to achieve that objective, along, of course, it's scriptural. Don't get all hung up on methods. Methods come, methods go. But the objective is the thing that we want to stress. Let me show you what I mean by that now. See, before I do that, grown people do not like to paint by numbers. See, my grandkids, you know what we do when we go to Tucson to be with the two grandkids, our little granddaughters down there? My wife takes along coloring books. And oftentimes it'll be these little number coloring books. You make all the twos purple and all the threes green and all the ones brown, and a picture appears. See? You paint by numbers. Now, that's okay for grandkids, but that is not good for adults. Adults like to exercise a little creativity, you know. And kids like to, as far as that goes. I remember hearing Walter Cronkite tell about a group in Egypt. And they were children. And they had developed some of the most phenomenal tapestries that anywhere in the world. They would take these little children, probably 12, 15, something like that, 12-year-olds, and they'd teach them to weave tapestries, teach them the techniques. And then they would say, paint a picture. And these little imaginations would go wild, you know. And they would paint, you know, their little childish imagination, and they would paint the most beautiful things, and these things were selling for thousands of dollars because they were such a creative, such new, fresh things. Now, see, what the average person would do, they would teach them to do these tapestries, and then they'd give them a horse and say, okay, do that. So then the kid would follow that and make the horse. Or do this row, so then the kid would do that. But when you tell a kid, paint me a picture, then that creativity goes to work. That's what you got to do when you're working with people. You got to tell them what the objective is, and then let them figure it out and move through it and do all kinds of stuff. Okay, Ezra chapter 8. Let's follow this through here now. Come with me to Ezra chapter 8. Verse 21. Someone read for us Ezra chapter 8, 21 through 23, if you would, please. And tell us what translation you're reading from.
New American Standard.
All right.
Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava, that we may humble ourselves before our God and seek from him a safe journey for us, our little ones, and all our possessions. For I was ashamed to request from the king troops and horsemen to protect us from the enemy on the way, because we had said to the king, the hand of our God is favorably disposed to all those who seek him, but his power and his anger are against all those who forsake him. So we fasted and sought our God concerning this matter, and he listened to our entreaty.
Okay. Situation is, here is Ezra, and he's got to go up to Jerusalem. And it's a treacherous, treacherous journey. All kinds of bandits and thieves and robbers in the way and all like that. But Ezra says, you know what? That's the way my grandkids start every sentence. You know what? And then you got to say what, and then they'll tell you. So, really? So, you know what? What? Yeah. Ezra said, "Here's what we're going to do. See, I'm not gonna shame the Lord by asking for chariots and horsemen and soldiers and so on to take us up there safe. I'm going to go down by the river of Ahava. I'm going to proclaim a fast. We're going to fast and pray. And then we're going to trust God to get us up there to Jerusalem. And we'll just believe he'll do it. And we'll just trust the Lord." So he goes down by the river and he fasts and prays, and God hears his prayer and he goes up and he's there safely. Who read that? Did you read that? Okay. Would you read for us now in Nehemiah 2, 7 through 9?
And I said to the king, the If it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go. And the king granted them to me because the good hand of God was on me. Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with me officers of the army and horsemen.
Yeah. Nehemiah says, you know, God, it'd be nuts to go from here up there to Jerusalem without letters of safe passage and horsemen and soldiers and chariots and whatever else. That'd be crazy to make this kind of a trip without that kind of help. So he gets these letters of safe passage, and these guys give him horsemen and soldiers, and they march up there and protect him along the way, and he arrives in safety. Okay, Ezra goes down by the river and proclaims a fast, trust God only, and God takes him there in safety. Nehemiah goes over here, gets all these letters and horses and armies and soldiers and whatever else, and God takes him there in safety. Who was right? Both right, of course. They're both right. The objective was to get to Jerusalem, right? This guy used this method, that guy used that method. And God used them both. So, methods, immaterial. Ezra 9, verse 3. When I heard this thing, there's sin in the camp. When I heard this thing, I rent my garment and my mantle and plucked off the hair of my head and off my beard and sat down astonished. I don't know what astonished is, but people would go by and they'd see him astonished here, I guess, and they'd say, hark, he's astonished, so they'd stop sinning. And really, all the sin stopped. We'll go back to Nehemiah 13. Nehemiah chapter 13. Nehemiah finds the people sinning. Verse 21. And I testified against them and said, why lodge you about the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. From that time forth, they came no more on the Sabbath. Look at verse 25. More sin. And I contended with them and cursed them and smote certain of them and plucked off their hair and made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons or for yourselves. Ezra saw sin in the camp, pulled his hair out. Nehemiah saw sin in the camp, pulled their hair out. Who was right? They're both right. So never get hung up on methods, see? The objective is to stamp out sin in the camp, right? So in a position of leadership, when you're thinking about, you know, accomplishing something for God, make sure that everybody is in total agreement on what the objective is, and then allow all kinds of freedom and liberty to achieve that objective as long as it is scriptural. So, a little lesson there on delegation and on initiative. Turn with me into Mark chapter 2. Mark chapter 2. And again he entered into Capernaum after some days, and it was noisy, he was in the house. And straightway many were gathered together, so much there was no room to receive a note about the door, and he preached the word unto them. And they came unto him bearing one sick of the palsy, which was born of four. And when they could not come nigh unto him for the press, you know how the press is always crowding in with their cameras and everything, could not come nigh him for the press, they uncovered the roof where he was, and when they had broken it up, they let down the bed where the sick of the palsy lay. Now, you know why I like this passage? It says very clearly that they could not get close to him. They could not get the man to him, right? But they did. That's a challenge. They couldn't do it, but they did. Now, it was a little unconventional what they did, and it's probably never been done before or since, but they did it. So allow for all kinds of creativity. You can imagine Jesus here preaching, and pretty soon little things begin to fall. You know, you can't do that. You can't have people crawling on the roof and tearing up the roof when Jesus is preaching, you know. But they did, and Jesus commended them, right? So allow for all kinds of creativity and innovative ideas and so on. May never be done again, may never be done before, but what does that matter? Okay. Someone read for me. Numbers 1, 1 through 3. Numbers 1, 1 through 3.
Census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel by their families, by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old and upward, whoever is able to go out to war in Israel, you and Aaron shall number them by their armies.
Okay. You can just see Moses going along here. And all of a sudden the Lord says, okay, here it is. I want you to count everybody. Count everybody. Yeah? I want you to count everybody. Well, I am busy. You know, I mean, I've got my hands full. I'm trying to get these people across this desert. I mean, the desert's opening up and they're swallowing them up here and there and things are happening. And I'm night and day dealing with some problem, leading these millions of people across the desert, keeping them from rebellion and the fiery serpents and all kinds of stuff going on. And I am writing the Bible. I am writing the Bible, you know. And now you want to stop and count everybody, right? I mean, Moses is human. Is Moses human? Moses is human. But he got the job, and it says he got the job on the first day of the second month in the second year. Verse 8, look at it. And they assembled all their congregation in the first day of the second month. If you want to get something done, especially a distasteful job, get it done quickly. Put your hand to it and do it. Because you can sit around and stew and fret and worry and bite your nails and get all upset and in turmoil and get all agitated inside. Or you can drop everything and get the thing done and go back to what you enjoy doing. Never give yourself time to let yourself sort of, when you're given a job like this, like counting, or there's nothing particularly glamorous about going around counting everybody. But the principle is this. To get more done, don't waste time getting at the job, especially if it's a distasteful job. Let me give you an illustration. I was out with Bill Greenaway one time when he lived in Oakland, California, and we were on our way down to Fort Ord to preach the gospel. Then we were going from there directly to a pizza place where Gene Powell had some guys together for a pizza deal and the gospel. And so I was going to go to Fort Ord, preach, hop in a car, run over here and preach. And I like to do that. They reminded me I wasn't going to get anything to eat that night, but that's okay. You know, I was going to get a chance to preach. So we were just pulling out, and a special delivery thing showed up for Leroy Imes. It was a packet, one of these brown manila envelopes you know, like they have, full of papers, personnel forms. They had these people they were considering for overseas assignment, and here were all these personnel forms, and the note from Dolores Preble, I think, said, Leroy, we need these right away. Okay, I'm on my way now to Fort Ord, then over here, missing supper, getting a late night that night, heading the next day for Hume Lake, where we had a conference going up there, going down from Hume and going down to Fresno, and it was one of these, you know, schedules, unbelievable. And here I stand with this packet in my hand. Now, I could have said, look, you know, Lord, you know I'm busy, right? You know I'm busy. Stuck it in my briefcase and just carried it with me for the next few days. But every time I opened my briefcase, there'd be that thing nagging at me down there. You know, I'm still here. Here I am. Down, you know. Shut up. Quiet. So I told Bill Greenaway, shut off the car. So he turned off the car. And I sat down and I filled him out. It took about, 45 minutes. But sat there and filled him out. And I said, okay, Bill, let's take off. And one of the guys was there, I said, would you get this in the mail to Dolores Preble? And he did, and so on. When you're given a job, and it's a job that's not really your thing, but it's part of your responsibility. Get the thing, do it, get it done with, and then get on with what you enjoy doing. Otherwise, the thing is always nagging at you there, you know, wanting to get done. Principle is, if you want to get more done, do it now. Just do it now. Get it over with. Don't let it sit around and nag you. Now would someone read for us Numbers 11, 24 through 29. As soon as you find it, just read it for us and tell us what translation you're using.
New American Standard, verse 24.
Yeah, and Numbers 11, chapter 11, verses 24 through 29.
So Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord. Also gathered 70 men of the elders of the people, and they should have been around the tent. The Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him, and he took of the Spirit who was upon him and placed him upon the 70 elders. Came about that when the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied. They did not do it again. The two men had remained in the camp. The name of one was Eldad, and the name of the other was Medad. The Spirit rested upon them. Now they were among those who had been registered, but had not gone up to the tent. And they prophesied in the tent. So a young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Then Joshua the son of Nun, the attendant of Moses, from his youth answered and said, Moses, my Lord, restrain them. But Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit upon them.
Okay, thank you. Situation here is that the Spirit of God comes upon certain men and they begin to prophesy. Joshua sees it, becomes a little jealous for Moses' authority and kind of the leader, and he goes and tells Moses, forbid them, he says, restrain them. Verse 29, Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? Would God that all the Lord's people were prophets, and the Lord would put his hand upon all of them. Now, in light of that, keep that tucked in the back of your mind. In light of that, would someone read for us 1 Samuel 18, verses 6 through 9? Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. On the one hand, would God all the Lord's people were prophets? You know, would that God would put his spirit on all of them? Pray, are you jealous for my sake? Forget it. We would just love to have God do this for every man in the camp. Over here, Saul looked at David with suspicion. Why? He was jealous. Here was a young guy who was coming up and exercising some leadership. And Saul didn't want to see him do that. Didn't want that to happen. When you're in a position of leadership, no matter what it is, anywhere there is, there's always going to be those that are kind of coming along that looks like one day you may be reporting to them. You know, here you are maybe the leader of the thing, but pretty soon thing may change, and you got to watch that. You really got to watch that. Jealousy is one of those things that can kill a leader off. And the only attitude that you can have that really makes any sense is Moses' attitude. Would God that all of the Lord's people were prophets. Thank God for them. I hope they succeed. I hope they do great, you know. As opposed to the King James says, I love the King James, and Saul eyed David from that day forward. You can see old Saul sitting there eyeing David, saying, this guy, we got to watch him, because he's getting a little bit too much authority. He's getting a little bit too much power. He's getting a little bit too much adulation. He's getting a little too much prominence. People are noticing him too much. A good leader says, thank God for that. If you ask Lauren Sanney, what motivates you? Isn't Lauren going to teach you the FOM one of these days? That is going to be a treat. That is going to be something it'll blow your minds. That'll really be a treat. If during question and answer time, if you ask Lauren, what motivates you? You know what he'll say? He'll say, well, helping make big ones out of little ones. Helping people that wouldn't amount to a hill of beans amount to something for God. Lauren is always behind the scenes, and he's always pushing people out. Years and years ago, when I was in Lincoln, Omaha, this must have been in 56, somebody came from an Air Force base out here and asked the navigators if one of them would come out and preach a Protestant mission on the base. Well, they wanted Lauren, of course, but Lauren called me. Now, here I'm a young guy in Omaha, Nebraska. And he said, Leroy, they want this Protestant mission preached out here. Would you consider coming out and being the evangelist at this thing? How old was I at 56? Just a young guy, see. So I thought, well, okay. So I came out, and guess who's on the front row every night cheering me on? Lauren Sanney. Down there, you know. So a few months later, he's supposed to be speaking at a weekend conference in California. Something came up, he couldn't go. So he called me in Omaha and said, Leroy, would you consider going to California to to speak at a weekend. I'd never spoken at a weekend conference. Who in the world am I to speak at a weekend conference, for Pete's sake? I mean, that's for big people, you know. That's for grown-ups. That's for leaders, you know. Who am I? Well, I thought, okay, I guess. So I think it was Russ Johnson and Bob Stevens, and I hopped in the car and drove to Southern California. I showed up. I said, Lawrence Annie's not coming. I'm here to speak. I couldn't sink in. When will Lauren get here? Lauren is not coming. See, Lauren isn't coming. He's asked me to speak. Who are you? I'm Leroy Iams. But when is Lauren coming, you know? And for years he did that. Push. Himself stay back here somewhere, and you know. That's what a good leader does. A good leader really works at helping people for whom he has a responsibility really amount to something for God. And when it begins to show up that they're going to amount to something for God, don't eye them from that time on, you know. But thank God for them. Would God all the Lord's people were prophets, right? Well, there's two or three other things that we need to cover. It's 3 o'clock. We'll come back. I'll cover those things. We're not going to last till 5 o'clock, so...